Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Deborah England, Senior Program Officer at the Corrett Foundation and your chair for the program. Tonight's program is part of the Principles of a Free Society series, which is underwritten by the Corrett Foundation. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute and author of the new book, The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. I must tell you, you're in for a treat. Our speaker tonight is that rarest of creatures, a modern Renaissance man. Since 2009, Arthur has been president of the American Enterprise Institute. This is a think tank in Washington, D.C., that works to support liberty, individual opportunity, and strengthening free markets. Prior to that, Arthur was a professor of business and government policy at Syracuse University, where his research focused on economics, entrepreneurship, and philanthropy. He is the author of 8 books, including a broad range of topics ranging from national happiness, who really cares philanthropically, and graduate textbook in social entrepreneurship. Most interestingly, and unusual for an academic of his caliber and standing, he spent 12 years playing French horn at the City Orchestra of Barcelona and other assorted symphonies. What I'd like to share with you is a small anecdote from my first exposure to Arthur, which gives you a little bit of insight into the man behind these credentials. Arthur stood up to talk about the book Who Really Cares, which is an in-depth study that he's done on philanthropy. And he introduced us to the topic, explaining that he had done, I should explain to you, he has done his PhD at RAND. And if you know anything about a RAND PhD program, it is extraordinarily quantitatively rigorous. This is a man who knows how to crunch numbers and knows how to deal with data. And as he explained to us in the audience, he had come from a very classically liberal, democratic family, and he believed, going into this work, that the data would, of course, show him that the greatest part of generosity and who really cares in terms of philanthropic giving would be the classically liberal, democratic types of folks which represented the background he came from. And after he crunched the data, the conclusions that he found were a little surprising to him. They didn't quite line up with his expectations going in, and he assumed that he'd crunched the data wrong. So he turned the data upside down, inside out, crunched it every which way from Sunday, and finally came to the conclusion, as one finds in a good classical scholar, that the data had to take him someplace else than where he had originally begun. And I wanted to share this anecdote with you because I believe that beyond all the credentials, beyond all the awards and the honors and the important position that he holds as president of American Enterprise Institute, that this one anecdote is revelatory of the exquisite flexibility and agility and the qualities of a true scholar that are evident in a mind that can take evidence and data and argumentation and find that it brings them to a place that they didn't expect to go when they started. And so that's why I say you're in for a treat. This is a man of true scholarship and a delightful human being, and I'm very pleased to introduce you to him.
Thank you, Deborah. That was very kind. I'll try to live up to it. It's an honor to be with you here at the Commonwealth Club. I've been looking forward to this. This is an important speaking series. It's an example of how people around the United States can and should have access to ideas, and I congratulate all of you who have taken some time. I appreciate the fact that you've taken some time to come and hear my remarks tonight, and also to greet those who are listening to us and watching us and on the internet. I'm going to talk to you tonight about free enterprise, to be sure, but most of all, I want to talk to you tonight about happiness. I want to talk to you about something I think is more important than free enterprise and free markets and indeed economics. I want to talk to you about what I think is the currency in which we trade in all of our daily lives, which is happiness itself. I want to tell you a little bit about modern research on the subject of happiness, and only then do I want to relate it back to our current economic situation and submit it to you for your consideration. And the reason I want to do this is because the study of happiness deeply affected me as a scholar. When I was at Syracuse University, where I spent a lot of years before I came to the American Enterprise Institute, at one point I was coming up for full professor. And as many of you know, full professor is a rank in university which basically means you have no more adult supervision in your life. You can do practically anything, felonious or otherwise, and it's more protection than the French bureaucracy. And I asked myself, what is my responsibility as a full professor? What am I supposed to do with this, all this protection? Now, you might think to yourself, academic freedom. But most in the academy, as you know, or many in the academy, as you probably know, don't use it like this. They often use the protection that comes from a full professorship to work less, to be a little bit less productive. And I think that that's the wrong approach. So I thought to myself, what classically would we do with this kind of protection? What would we do with academic freedom? And I thought to myself, I need to do a study of my own past research and see whether or not it's making a difference, whether or not it's actually changing the lives of people, whether or not it's improving the lot of other human beings around me. Now, at the time, I was doing a lot of work on taxation. I'm an economist, which is to say I specialize in asking questions nobody's ever asked. And trying to answer them. And that means that you tend to lead down paths that are not very relevant occasionally. And looking at my own research, I came to the conclusion that I was not doing work that was very impactful. Now, how did I find this out? Well, I was doing work on the estate tax at the time, which, as many of you know, is a very controversial tax. 2/3 of Americans say it's the most unfair tax in our tax code. And I was going out and talking to actual humans, which is kind of a lost art in academia. I was going out and talking to people about how they felt about the inheritance tax, the estate tax. And I found some funny things. For example, I noticed that people in the bottom income quartile really hate this tax. This is puzzling to me because, as I would explain to people in the bottom income quartile, you should love this tax. You'll never pay it, but it will pay for services that disproportionately will go to services that benefit you. Why don't you love it? It's efficient for you. And they say, you don't understand. I don't care if it's efficient. It makes me less free in this country, and I think it's not fair for people to have to pay this tax, even if I don't have to pay this tax. Now, we all can, until the cows come home, say that that's irrational on the part of people of limited means. And in academia, you tend to explain this away with some sort of neo-Marxist rhetoric, saying that people are under a false consciousness or something. But most Americans think that's nonsense. They understand that economic efficiency is not the whole show. Now, as an economist, I'm saying real heresy here. But what really matters to most people is freedom and fairness. This is what really dominates in an already rich society for lots of people, including people in the bottom of the income distribution. And I realized I wasn't doing my research on the right stuff, on economic efficiency, about taxes. I needed to talk about what people really cared about. Why did they care about the fairness and freedom? And so I started asking people about that, and they said, it's about how happy the system makes us. It's about how happy public policies make us. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to be a full professor in academia, it's time for me to write something about the economics of happiness. It's time for me to figure out what lies behind the equations, what's really making people tick. Now, the first question I had at this point was, as an economist, can you really measure happiness? And the answer, surprisingly, is yes, you can. There's 30 years of data in the social psychology literature that shows that anonymous surveys among broad groups of Americans, when you get a large enough group of people and you ask them anonymously, you get a pretty good idea, an honest idea of how happy those people are. There are even studies that compare surveys. How happy would you say you are in your life, all things considered? That's the typical question. And they compare it to more intrusive studies, things that use functional MRI, things that that look at studies of the brain, things that look at word association, very intrusive, very expensive types of data gathering, turn out they all lead you to the same conclusion, that when you just ask people, how happy, all things considered, would you say you are in your life, you get pretty honest, pretty accurate answers. I mean, you can't ask people in front of other people. You can't ask me in front of my wife, how happy would you say you are, for example. I mean, blissful. You know, that, you know, it's that because people are funny that way. But if you ask them anonymously, you know, they tend to give you very accurate answers. Now, this is wonderful news to an economist like me, because now I can actually go to the source of what's making people tick, and I can get some big databases. Databases are like catnip to economists. I can crunch numbers on what makes people happy and what the empirical differences are between happy and unhappy people in the United States and maybe even around the country. But I still had one more question before I could start doing research on this topic, and that was this. Can we really, with public policy, can we really affect people's happiness? This is a question that you may have asked yourself. Can your happiness ever really be permanently affected? And you might doubt that that's the case. You might have noticed, like I have, that your moods always tend back to where they've traditionally been in the past. So if you're a grumpy person, people all probably say to you, no matter what good thing happens to you, you always seem really grumpy. Or you're one of these cheerful people say, why are you so cheerful, even when bad things are happening? People tend toward the ruts in their mood. You've probably noticed. And that observation has not been lost on psychologists. Psychologists noting that mood tends with different people to stay in a particular place even throughout their lives have asked how much of our happiness is inherited and how much of it comes from the changes throughout our lives and our behaviors and even things like public policies. Now, how do you figure out how much of happiness is nature and how much of happiness is nurture? And the ingenious answer to that comes from studies on identical twins. There are studies of identical twins and other siblings who are taken and put in different households at birth through adoption, and then using statistical techniques, we can see when we interview them as they grow up how much of their personalities are inherited and how much of their personalities come from their different environments. The shocking answer is that much more of our personalities than we ever understood can be shown to be inherited. Now, Americans, we like to think that everything is on the table, that you can change anything about anybody with some sort of perfect intervention. I deal with a lot of people who are very involved in education policy. And what we all want to think in education policy, if you just get the right first grade teacher, everything's going to be okay. And it's a great idea that the blank slate of the American mind. It's a wonderful thing. It's how immigrants think. If I can come to a new place, everything is going to be all right. Let's start again. I mean, starting again is this hallmark of the American experience. Thomas Jefferson said that an American is a man who moves west the first day he hears the sound of his neighbor's axe. Right? Let's start again is the whole idea. It turns out the data are not very sympathetic to the notion that we really are a blank slate. You find, for example, that about 40% of how you vote is genetic. 40% of how religious you are is genetic. Virtually every important part of your personality, from extroversion to criminality to neuroticism to alcoholism, has a huge genetic component to it. And so it is also, I'm sorry to tell you, with happiness. Studies using identical twins show that between 50 and 80% of your baseline happiness is actually inherited, which is pretty depressing when you think about it. And you know, I remember when I first came across these studies, and they're very well done studies. They're unimpeachable studies. Up to 80% of your happiness is genetic. I discussed it with my wife, and she said, "See, I told you your mother made you unhappy." Turns out quite literally true for many of you, or happy for that matter. So 50 to 80% is inherited. So what's the use of looking at what tax policy does to people's happiness? What's the use? And the answer is, even if 20%, especially if only 20% of your happiness can be changed by your behaviors and your circumstances and by your country and your opportunity, you really should get everything right. And here's how I figured that out. Not directly. I figured that out very indirectly. I was working with a guy who was almost exactly my age. We were in academia together. He was an economist like me. He went to his doctor, and his doctor told him something very strange, which is that he had about 15 years left to live. He was in his early 40s, and he had 15 years left to live. And it was because of a congenital heart issue that, unless medical science changed a lot, he was very likely to have a catastrophic event before about 15 years were up. Now, what do you hear if you go to the doctor and you say you've got 15 years left to live? You don't come home and mope around and watch a lot of daytime TV. You got 15 years. On the other hand, you just found out you don't have 40 years left to live. You have a fraction of that. So what would you do? Well, I bet you'd do what he did. He came home, he thought about it, and he said, you know what I'm going to do? I have 15 years instead of 40, so I'm going to take 40 years of happiness, and I'm going to stuff it into 15 years. I'm going to be a better father, and a better husband, and a better citizen, and a better employee, and a better everything. I'm going to have a happier life than I had before. And the truth is, he's doing it. He comes home from work, and he says to his wife, sweetheart, get the kids. We've never been to Turkey. Let's go to Istanbul. I mean, who lives this way? It's appalling, quite frankly. But this is how he's living, because he's trying to get 40 years of happiness and stuff it into 15. It was a life-inflecting event for my friend. Now, what was the principle of this? If you have less of the resource than you thought, use it wisely. So if you thought you could change 100% of your happiness and you could only change 20% or 30% or 40%, better get that 20, 30, or 40% right. Don't make any dumb decisions. Don't make any systematic errors. And if you're in my business and you try to be ethical about it, don't promote any policies that are going to make that 20% worse for people. So now really the game is on. As an economist, for me, I thought, now it really matters what kind of policies we have. Now it really matters what kind of country we have. And I want to know, in my heart, what's the best system to make most people most happy. That is my ethical goal. This is my scholarly objective for the rest of my career. That's what I decided in that moment. And that's what I've dedicated myself to for the last several years. So, question. What would make you happier? When you ask people about this, a lot of people talk about money. So, for example, if I ask you, what would you do if you hit the lottery? None of you say, well, I think I'd start by having somebody close to me take advantage of me, and then I think I'd fall into an alcoholic spiral. I mean, nobody says that, right? You think about good things that would happen to you in your life, not bad things that would happen to you in your life. I've got some data on lottery winners I'm going to tell you about in a minute. But you think about good things. And as a matter of fact, most people, when they think about how they could be happier, their minds immediately go towards something that would change their economic circumstances. This is funny, right? Because remember your mother told you that money didn't buy happiness, and your rabbi told you that money didn't buy happiness, and so forth and so on. Remember that? So were they completely crazy? Or is there something weird in our minds that says we want more, we want to acquire more, we want to have more stuff? But at the same time, everybody knows it won't buy happiness. So what's the deal? I think it'll make me happy, but I know it won't. So this is a cognitive dissonance. How do we resolve it? Economists have gone right to the source and say, let's just settle this thing. Does money buy happiness or does money not buy happiness? Let's look at the data. Now, there are three ways to answer this question. And the first way we ask, what's the difference between poor countries and rich countries? Are rich countries happier than poorer countries? The second way is to ask, what would happen if a country got richer? On average, would people get happier? And the third way to answer this question is, what happens to individuals when they get richer? So in your life, what would happen? Okay, so what do the data say? The data turn out to be pretty clear. Are rich countries happier than poor countries? And the answer is usually not. I know that's kind of waffling, but let me explain. Once countries get above the basic level of subsistence, it's almost impossible to make populations happier simply with money. So if you go to the most miserable countries in the world, you'll find they're in sub-Saharan Africa because people are dying of preventable diseases and people are dying of starvation. That doesn't make anybody happy. Everybody hates that. I mean, newsflash. I mean, this is not exactly rocket science. But you find that once people get above the level of subsistence, and the level of subsistence is actually quite low, people don't get happier very much just because of money. Okay, so for example, you find that the French have about 3 times the average purchasing power than the average Mexicans. But the Mexicans are almost twice as likely to say that they are very happy people. Now, maybe that makes you happy. It depends on your views about the French. But, you know, why is that? Why is that? And it has all to do with non-economic things. It has to do with family. It has to do with faith. It has to do with community. It has to do with a sense of vocation and the attachment to one's job, all of which the French tend to be very weak on and the Mexicans tend to be very strong on. That's the life in life. That's what explains the difference. So you get above this level of subsistence and it's really flat and money's not doing it. Strike one, for money buys happiness. Now, the second way is, what would happen if our country got a lot richer? Would our country get happier? Now, we can look at this directly. If you go back to the early 1970s and compare it to now, you find that the average citizen in purchasing power has about 50% more than in the early 70s. Now, and that means really more stuff. It's not just, you look at housing in San Francisco and you say, yeah, but you know, you can't buy the house you used to. Sure. On average, there's 50% more real purchasing power, more cars, more food, more vacations, more stuff that people can get. So the question is, with 50% more purchasing power on average per citizen, how much happier are we? And the answer is, we're not. In 1972, 31% of Americans said that they were very happy. Today, 31% of Americans say that they're very happy. It doesn't matter what happens. Between 30 and 35% of people say they're very happy. Between 50 and 55% say they're somewhat happy. And the rest of the people say they're not happy. Year in and year out. It doesn't matter what political party they belong to. It doesn't matter who's in power. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican and Barack Obama got elected. It doesn't matter. It turns out it has all to do with life circumstances, and they're really, really set in the United States. Strike two. People aren't getting happier, even though Americans are getting richer. Now, if you're like me, you're thinking, fine, all of these aggregates, countries and whole countries over time, that's all great. But if I got a lot more money, I'd be happier because I know how to use it. I could really spend the money wisely and I could do all these great things that would make me happier. Okay, true? No. No, you probably couldn't. Now, I have data in particular on unearned income. I'm going to talk about earned income a little bit later, but unearned income is a really interesting set of studies and data because you can look at what happens when people go from poor to rich just like that. I have data on major Powerball lottery winners. There are studies on this, people who go from 0 to 30 million overnight. How much happier do you think they get? Now, I kind of signaled this a little bit earlier. And the answer is they don't get happier. You find that when people win the lottery, they tend to be happier for about 6 months. That's when the euphoria of having all the stuff and having all the economic security and being able to buy anything that you want is still there. But it wears off. After 6 months, it wears off. And what you find is that they don't just go down to where they were. They go below and they stay there. Why do they stay there? And the answer is they never enjoy the little things in life ever again. You find that after people hit the lottery and they come down from the high, they don't enjoy spending the money anymore. And furthermore, they don't enjoy family, they don't enjoy friends, they don't enjoy pastimes, they don't enjoy hobbies. They don't enjoy watching television, they don't enjoy going shopping. All of that life gets blunted in its enjoyment. All the stuff you like to do on the weekend is no fun anymore, and it never is. Truly, I can tell you that if you buy a lottery ticket, the best thing that can happen to you is that you don't win. It's a curse. And all forms of unearned income are a curse as well. I have data on inheritance. Some of you are saying, I don't play the lottery. And there's something different about the people who play the lottery. Fair enough. They're usually poor. They usually have other things going on in their lives. So what about people who inherit money instead? Some of you are in this circumstance of probably leaving something to your kids or having your parents leave something to you. A lot of Americans are. Will that make you happy? And the answer is no. We have data that focus on income that follows people over the course of their lives, and we know where the income came from, and we know how happy they are. And statistically, we can't find any connection between inherited income and changes in happiness. Furthermore, when you do larger studies looking at people who've inherited a lot of money, you find that the insecurity that they're most likely prone to is the belief that they have not actually created value of their own merit. Now, that truly is a tyranny. Imagine going through your life wondering if you did it on your own, if you really earned your own success. I'm going to come back to that idea in just a second, because it turns out that's the key to happiness. But if you don't get it because you inherit and you wonder about yourself or because you win the lottery, it's a tyranny for you. It's a curse for you. It's something you really need to avoid. Strike three, money doesn't buy happiness. Ah, but there's a catch. One of you might be thinking, or more of you might be thinking, sure, it's not enough to have more. You can't get happier by having more, but you can get happier by having more than somebody else. And this is something that psychologists have found, that actually relative income looks pretty good. You find that people who earn $75,000 or more are twice as likely to say they're very happy as people earning $25,000 or less in the same community. So you find that richer people in a small community tend to be happier than poorer people in a small community. As a matter of fact, people always want to have more than their neighbor. There's a study from the Harvard School of Public Health in the mid-90s that asked people to choose between two alternative communities. Community number one, you earn $50,000 a year and all your neighbors earn $25,000 a year. And community number two, you earn $100,000 a year and your neighbors earn $200,000 a year. Which one did people choose? 56% chose community one, in which they were actually poorer but richer than the schlub next door. Now, it's sort of the window onto the soul, right? And it's kind of, you know, I don't care how much I have, I just want to have more than him, right? And when I was a kid, my dad, who had a great sense of humor, he used to say, son, it's not enough to win. Your friends have to lose, too. It was this basic principle, it seems, at work. So how do we translate that into public policy? What does this mean for public policy? A lot of people have looked at these data on their face and say, it's all just relative. And relative doesn't matter. And furthermore, when people are just trying to acquire to have more than their neighbors, they do bad things to the environment, they acquire too much stuff, and they're on a rat race. They're on something that economists call the hedonic treadmill. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to equal it out. We're going to look at all of you, and we're going to say, you have more than average. So I'm going to take some of your stuff away, and I'm going to give it to people who have less than average. I might be complicated about it. I might have a redistribution program that doesn't look just like taking from Peter and giving to Paul. But ultimately, it's going to be redistributive, because that's better for society. And that's an ideology that's gone through academia for a really long time. The trouble is, it's wrong. And the reason it's wrong is not just philosophically or religiously. You might say yes or you might say no. Reasonable people disagree on that. It's because the data don't support it. The variable we have to keep in mind is called earned success. I just introduced it a minute ago. When we ask people how much success they feel that they have earned, all of the differences in money go away statistically. Now, what is earned success? It's to believe that you have created value in your life or the life of other people by virtue of your own merit. If you believe you have earned your success, doesn't matter if it's denominated in money or otherwise, you will be happier, according to the data. Now, in a free market economy, typically people who earn a lot of success, they draw money to themselves. That's just how capitalism tends to work. But it is the earned success and not the money that explains differences in happiness. As a matter of fact, I have data on social entrepreneurs, people who count their success not in dollars, people who count their success in souls saved, or kids eating, or communities cleaned up, or people listening to chamber music, or the success of a nonprofit organization like this. Social entrepreneurs have every bit as much earned success and happiness as commercial entrepreneurs, and together they are the happiest people in the United States today, people who believe they've had a lot of earned success. Okay, so then the question is, how do we get more earned success? What do we get? Now, one of the things that we know is that income inequality on its face will not bring unhappiness. That's true. Furthermore, we know that income redistribution for the sake of redressing income inequality won't bring happiness, but But there's actually one more fact, which is when we have policies that try to redistribute income, since they can't spread around what really matters, which is earned success, what they do is they attenuate the willingness and ability of people to be entrepreneurs, and they earn less success, and they become less happy. This is the irony and the paradox of income redistribution. It always promises happiness, but it always delivers misery. Why? Because it's trying to spread around money, and it's doing nothing to earn success. This leads me to what I believe is one of the great moral imperatives of our time, which is how can we lead more people to earn their success? Now, I have an answer to it that you may or may not agree with, which is the system that matches people's skills most with their passions and which most Americans believe leads them to earn their success. And that's the free enterprise system. That's the reason that I believe that the free enterprise system is not an economic alternative. It truly is a moral imperative. That's the reason I believe a lot in the free enterprise system. Not because of the tyranny of materialism, not because of the money at all. I don't care about the money at all, because money in an already rich country is not about the money. It's nothing more than a marker of earned success. Now, I'm not saying that for everybody, because there still are poor people. And my own personal view is that in a civilized society, we have an obligation to provide a minimum basic standard of living for everybody. I'm talking about above that, most people, for whom income redistribution is a curse, whether you're on the getting or taking side of it. And the only way you will improve your life materially through the economic system is by earning your success. This is political, but it's also personal. In my role as the president of AEI, I ask myself daily, what am I doing today to help more Americans, more employees, more friends, more people in my community earn more of their success? Now, I know a lot of you have thoughts like this too, maybe not exactly in these words, but the fact that you have thought about these things and the fact that many of you have created jobs and opportunity and growth, many of you have thought about basically the earned success of other people and have acted on it. For that reason, you've actually given us a happier, more prosperous country. So for that, I say thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute and author of the new book, The Battle: How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. I'm Lance Izumi, Corrett Senior Fellow at the Pacific Research Institute for Public Policy, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Dr. Brooks, we have a large number of questions, so let's begin. The first question: how does earned success vary across cultures? Is it entrepreneurs in the U.S., is it the same in other countries that don't have a deep myth of entrepreneurship? Or what about working your way up a corporation?
That's a wonderful question, and one that I've asked myself a lot. Is earned success the same in all countries and all cultures all the time? I want it to be true. I want everybody to have the same basic formula so that we can have a development policy and an outreach policy and an aid policy that actually leads to this. And in certain cases, we do find that people are much better off and display higher levels of happiness when they have more entrepreneurial opportunity. But I'm not willing to say based on the data yet that that is indeed universally true. Why is it that Europeans seem to want so different a set of societal circumstances and public policies than Americans? That's a real puzzle, actually. You know, when I talk to my friends in Sweden, they really don't want the American system very much, it would seem to me. And in point of fact, they're pretty happy. We have to recognize this. And the answer to this is almost certainly, get ready for it, we are different than they are. And how do we know we're different than they are? Well, we have a different set of social norms, we have a different set of circumstances, but there's even research that suggests we may be genetically different than the continent that provided the United States with the majority of its people. Why? Because what is the single most entrepreneurial act? It's the act that puts the most capital at risk, and that is called immigration. Immigrants are the ultimate entrepreneurs. If you take people who are the most entrepreneurial and you put them into another country, that might be a mutation in the host country, and the norm in the new country. If that's true, and there are researchers who are asserting this, this is not based on my own research, but there are researchers who are asserting this, we are a country of risk takers, a country of entrepreneurs, a country of people who truly are happiest under the free enterprise system, earning our success in that fashion. If that's the case, then I have to state with appropriate humility that this is not just the best, that this is the best system for America, but I want to know more before I try to impose it on somebody else.
Thank you. Another question asks, your recent book is called The Battle Between Free Enterprise and Big Government. Could you explain a little bit more about those two contending forces?
Well, I call my new book The Battle because I believe that we're not in an economic struggle in this country right now. I mean, you all turn on the news like I do, and you see people protesting. You see the Tea Party protesters, and you see a big electoral shift coming. And you see, you know, why are people getting so wrapped around the axle because of 4 or 5 percentage points on the tax code? I mean, why are people actually waving signs and marching down the street? Why are massive waves of people going to vote for different people than they voted for just a couple of years ago? And the answer can't be that we're in an economic argument. The answer has to be that we're in a cultural struggle. We're in a moment of cultural crisis. We're trying to figure out many people in the United States are trying to figure out who we are as a country. And under the circumstances, there are two competing camps. One is the one that grows the government toward a culture of European-style social democracy. And there are a lot of smart people who think that's the way for us to go. I mean, you go to academia, it's hard to find somebody who doesn't think that would be better for the United States. And there are a lot of other people in the United States who believe that we need to maintain our traditional culture of free enterprise as articulated by our founders. Now, the data say that about 70% want the latter and about 30% want the former. And that, in a nutshell, is the battle that we have going on in America today.
Another question questioner asks, should there be a distinction between productive profit, that is, profit produced from the production of a good, and speculative profit, such as the housing bubble in the free enterprise system?
Well, the housing bubble in the free enterprise system actually did not create a speculative profit. It created a speculative loss. And it created a speculative loss because the incentives that were set up didn't reflect the underlying realities of the market. Speculative profit does actually create liquidity. It creates financial markets that allows people to have collateral and capital and borrow. I mean, the fact that most of you own houses is because there is speculative profit to be made. And I dare say that any of you who've started a business or bought a house are kind of glad that that credit was available. The data, the extant data on world development shows that the biggest difference between countries that prosper and the countries that don't is the countries that prosper have access to capital markets, which is to say that they avail themselves of sources of speculative profit. Now, when it gets blinkered, is when all the signals get messed up. It's when we don't have proper information. Question is, why do we have improper information in the current crisis? Now, volumes have been written about that, but suffice it to say that there are two main camps. One is that the government started the crisis and manipulated the circumstances to create bad signals that metastasized into private markets. The other is that private markets were underregulated. I have a strong point of view, but nobody disagrees that this was actually distortion of private financial markets and a distortion of the system of speculative profit. So when markets work right, and when we don't have market failure, both kinds of profit actually lead to higher degrees of prosperity for Americans and people around the world.
Is there truly a possibility of free enterprise when the barriers to entry into business are insurmountable for the poorer populations in the United States?
When we have barriers to entry into the system of prosperity, when people cannot see that they have pathways to earn success, it is a sham. It's absolutely a sham. How do we get those barriers? Well, people don't have a good education. People don't have the same set of skills. There's a whole lot of discrimination. There is a system of crony capitalism or managed capitalism by the government that makes companies that are too big to fail and systematically penalizes entrepreneurs. Welcome to the world today, my friends, particularly in the latter case. It's getting harder and harder to be an entrepreneur in this country. Entrepreneurship is down. Why? Because entrepreneurs believe that they don't know what policies are going to be, so they don't hire and they don't start businesses. That's a fact based on the data. We have anti-entrepreneur policies right now, and those are barriers to pathways to earn success. And that is not just an economic problem. That's a moral problem.
Do you perceive any positive net effects from government taxes like the corporate tax or the gas tax?
We need a state. I know it sounds weird from a free marketeer like me, but we need a government. And the government, for two reasons. One is that markets fail and governments need to intervene. And the second is we need to create, in my view, a minimum basic standard of living for people. That's a civilized thing to do. And for both of those things, we actually need a state. We don't need the state entirely for that, but we need the state for those things. And we need money to run the state. And we get the money from taxes. We don't go around and say, make your voluntary contribution to the army, or we would have a pretty, pretty poor army, which maybe for some of you would be a great thing. But in general, we can't fund public goods that way. That's not how we do it. We actually need taxes to do that. What are the best sources of taxes? Well, some are more distortionary and more efficient, and some are more fair and some are less fair, and some make us less free and some have less implications for our freedom. And in point of fact, that corporate tax is an easy one to love because it doesn't look like it's coming out of somebody's pocket, but it's one of the worst taxes for us to actually earn our success because it's impeding our ability to come out of the financial crisis. We have today the second highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. That may come as a surprise to a lot of you, but it's true. And soon we'll have the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world because Japan is undertaking pretty massive corporate tax reform. So who cares? And the answer is all of the companies that are deciding whether or not to create jobs in America or create jobs overseas. We may not like the idea of profit. We may not be sympathetic to the idea of rich people. We might think that CEOs make too much money. But in a free society, when people are relatively boundaryless, and it doesn't matter if we pass laws, they're going to be boundaryless anyway. That's how the information idea society and economy and world really works. We're going to lose jobs and opportunity and earn success when we penalize entrepreneurs. And that's the biggest problem with those particular taxes. This is the paradox of all this stuff. The stuff that sounds easiest has generally the most unintended secondary consequences. And of course, that's why God created economists. Or somebody created economists. I'm not going to jump to the conclusion.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speaker today is Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, who is discussing his belief that the U.S. government inhibits the free market and, in turn, American prosperity. Where does public education fit into free enterprise? Can educating the public happen without big government?
Educating the public, of course, is a minimum basic standard. It's necessary but insufficient to allowing everybody to earn their success. So I think there are very, very few people who disagree with that. Where people, reasonable people, disagree and come to blows is over the execution of that reality. How do we actually give people opportunities through universal education? Education is going to be expensive, and it's almost certainly the case that it's going to soak up a good deal of money from the state. But the real question is not whether or not it's going to be expensive, but how expensive at the margin and how you spend the money. That's what we need to be thinking a whole lot about. That should be basically nonpartisan. If we can agree that school systems exist to give people equal opportunity and pathways to earn success, as opposed to primarily existing as a source of good jobs for teachers and administrators, then we can actually start down pathways to reform that utterly transcend right and left in this country. That's my view.
Republicans want to lower taxes, but in your book, you criticize President Obama's plans about giving whole segments of society a pass on taxes so they'd have no skin in the game, as you mentioned. Could you explain and differentiate these two seemingly parallel positions?
The American tax system does two things. One is that it's currently moving toward concentrating more and more of the tax burden on a very few people, and it's exempting more people from paying anything. So when people believe that the American tax system is actually less progressive and more regressive than the tax systems of many of our counterparts, they're largely wrong. We, in point of fact, have a larger percentage of our taxpayers or citizens, our working citizens, who pay nothing than most of our counterpart nations. Today, something like 38% of working Americans have no federal income tax liability. But if all goes the way it's supposed to go, according to the legislation or according to the laws that we see, that we envision, that'll be about 47% this coming January. One in two working Americans will have no federal income tax liability. It's extraordinary. And it's actually, given the fact that many taxes are refundable, people who have no liability at all on net for any kind of federal taxes, that's going up by an astonishingly fast rate as well. So here's the real question. It's not whether or not people should have lower taxes in general, less distortion to their willingness and ability to earn their success, but whether or not it's healthy for citizens to pay nothing to support their own state, nothing to actually understand that our country isn't free to operate. One, we know, and all of you know, I mean, we've experienced this in our lives. You pay nothing for a resource, you get the tragedy of the commons. You overuse the resource. That's the reason that you have less traffic on toll roads than on free roads. So what does it mean when people don't have any idea over the fact that their government is not a free good? You get overuse. You get distorted values. You get people who believe that it's not in their interest ever to cut back on the size of government. I bet all of you understand that there's some point at which you get diminishing returns on the size of government. Some of you may think that's a point further down the road than I think it is, but we all understand that the government can't do absolutely everything. The problem is when you're exempted from paying anything, that observation, that recognition tends not to come, or it tends to come very late, and that's a dangerous thing for our society.
Thank you. Another questioner asks, can you give some historical examples of free enterprise and its benefits to the United States, and can free enterprise run into problems?
Free enterprise can run into problems all the time when we don't have a culture that can properly support it. Now, I want to make one historical point. There's the canonical great book on the free enterprise system that motivated the entire modern capitalistic economic system was called The Wealth of Nations. It was written by Adam Smith in the year 1776, a really important year in the United States, although he was in Scotland. That was not his first book. In 1759, 17 years earlier, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, where he talked about a properly ordered society and a properly ordered culture and a properly ordered set of moral sentiments. We're only fooling ourselves. We think we don't need properly ordered moral sentiments. We don't need a good culture. We don't need a healthy culture and healthy society. And all we need is pure unbridled capitalism. It just doesn't work that way because people take advantage of each other. People don't have social norms. They have no sense of altruism. They have no sense of common care. They have no sense of social capital. And we know for a fact that that actually leads markets to fail. That's actually not a problem of free enterprise per se. It's part of the problem of the fallen condition of humans. So if we don't believe we need to take care of our culture to have a properly functioning free enterprise system, we're in for lots and lots of unfortunate experiences. And throughout history, we've had them.
Thank you. Can you explain in more detail how the European-style social democracy has harmed Europe?
The European-style social democracy is clearly the product of the consensus of Europeans. Anybody who believes it was just imposed on them by some sort of dictatorship is not really paying attention to how democracy, the democracy part of social democracy, has evolved over the past five decades. The trouble is that it's running into a tremendous number of unintended economic secondary consequences. We're finding that, I mean, look at Spain and Portugal and Greece and Ireland right now. These countries, of course, are economically collapsing under their own weight because the social democratic system simply is not affordable for those countries. I'm not talking about whether it's affordable for the United States. It's not affordable for those countries. They're rethinking dramatically, radically, how much they're spending on their social democratic systems. You find that the government expenditure is down nearly 40% in Greece. This is in a country that already has almost 20% unemployment. Why? Because they just don't have the money. This is what's leading to all these dramatic protests you see, people throwing Molotov cocktails, burning down their own buildings, because they're demanding that the government not do all these things to them. The government has no choice. So we want an example of how the social democratic system has led to real hardship in Europe. Turn on the TV.
Here's a question from somebody who wants to know a little bit more about you as a person. What do you do as president of the American Enterprise Institute? How is this work different from your previous work?
Yeah, what do I do all day? That's what my kids ask me, too. The American Enterprise Institute is a think tank that looks from the outside a lot like a university without students, which for many faculty would say is that that's the best kind of university. I'm not included among them. I love teaching. But it's 200 staff, 50 full-time scholars, and it's split into three basic divisions: economics, foreign and defense policy, and social policy and politics. We have a mission that says we're a community of scholars and supporters dedicated to three things: maximizing liberty, increasing individual opportunity, and strengthening the free enterprise system. Beyond that, the interpretation of those principles is entirely in the minds of the scholars. It's a ferment of real intellectual freedom, where our scholars are writing op-eds, they're writing books, they're blogging, they're writing white papers, they're submitting studies for academic publication, just like the best universities want with their faculty. And what do I do all day? I fundraise. And because it's an expensive operation to fund. It's an important thing. It's a really noble endeavor. I told you a minute ago that the guiding professional objective in my life is figuring out how people should use that 20 to 50% of their happiness that's at their disposal. And I believe that the way that I can do that is through public policies and private culture that lead people to earn their success. The best way I can possibly do that is through running a think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, where everybody's basically dedicated to this idea, which makes it a privilege to come talk to you, to get investors, and to do all the things that occupy somewhere between 70 and 80 hours a week.
Thank you. Do you see a role for government regulation in free enterprise? Is there a difference between regulation and redistribution, and are they both equally harmful to the economy?
There is absolutely a role for regulation in the free enterprise economy. When I say that the government has a role potentially when markets fail, there are four sources of markets failing. Anytime you see markets failing, it's one of four things. And I'm not going to turn this into an economics seminar. Too many of my students suffered through that for too many years. But there are four sources of markets failing: monopoly, cases where we have externalities, which basically things like pollution, public goods, things like the army and fire services and police services, and cases in which people have a tendency to exploit each other, which economists call information asymmetries. Those are the four cases in which markets tend to fail. Those are the four cases where governments can conceivably actually help markets to not fail so much. And those are four cases in which we actually need regulation. We have regulation against monopoly, and it's a good thing. We frequently have regulation so that polluters actually can't pollute with impunity. That's a good thing. I mean, it can go too far, obviously, and that's where people disagree. But in principle, there's nothing controversial about that. We have basically regulation, or we have subsidy that leads to public goods. Nobody believes you should go around and say it's your annual police department contribution pay up. We believe that something that most people believe is something that government should do, just like education, just like national security. And finally, we believe there should be regulation. So if you cheat somebody, you get in trouble. If you go and you steal somebody's car, you get in trouble, because predatory behavior can't be tolerated. Those are all cases of regulation. That's anybody who believes we should have no regulation actually doesn't understand economics. Is that the same as redistribution? Well, when we actually take from people who have more money to pay for public goods, and everybody gets equal access to the public good, that's redistribution. But it's not redistribution for the sake of making everybody equal. Redistribution becomes a noxious problem when it's a simple remedy to income inequality per se. Then it becomes really dangerous, and then it becomes truly contrary to the promises of earned success.
Thank you. Another questioner asks, who are you hoping is voted into office this November?
The best candidate. You know, AEI is a nonpartisan outfit, and you know, I'm personally a political independent, and I have been for a long time. If any of you take time to read my latest book, you'll find almost equal doses of criticism for both parties. My view is that the march away from free enterprise, the march toward redistribution, the march toward policies that are inappropriate, started long before the election of President Barack Obama. In the last presidential administration, we had 55,000 spending earmarks without one presidential veto because of abusive spending. We had the largest entitlement expansion in the history of the United States in Medicare Part D. We had an expansion of the much-loathed federal Department of Education by 54% in real dollar terms. I say much-loathed by most Americans. That's actually not the work of a really gung-ho, pro-free enterprise party. And the result of that, I mean, basically what we're finding now is that today's cultural struggle is not conservatives versus liberals, it's not Democrats versus Republicans, it's citizens versus an ever-expanding government. That's really the danger that we face. And anybody, in my view, is the best political system is one in which we have a virtual cage match between Democrats and Republicans to show who's more pro-entrepreneur. because that's ultimately what's best for Americans.
Thank you. In your book, you say that young people are the most susceptible to the message of socialism. In a post-Soviet era, how do you address this issue?
Well, and when I say that, we find that young, and this is an empirical observation, people between 18 and 29 are far less likely to express antipathy, animus, hostility toward the concept of socialism than people in the past. And that's simply an historical artifact. I'm 46. So when I was you ask me what socialism, I think of Stalin. I think of these soul-crushing phenomena from before the end of the Iron Curtain. That's what socialism means to people my age, typically. If I ask my students at Syracuse what socialism, they say, oh, it's my professors. Right? They say, guys who look like you, they say. You know, that's what a socialist looks like. And it's simply because it's a different world under the circumstances. If you join me in believing that socialism is dangerous, it's damaging for the human soul, and it destroys human flourishing, it's incumbent upon you to show people that in the current generation, to show them what real socialism really means, both in your past and what it can mean for their future.
Thank you. Where do you stand on France's pension reform, and how does it fit into the two models you've presented?
France's pension reform is it's comically absurd to Americans. They're shutting down their country because they can't agree, because the protesters won't agree that the retirement age should move from 60 to 62. I mean, think about it. Should we work all the way until 62, or should we work only till 60? I'm going to shut down the airport. I mean, it's comically hard for Americans to understand that. It's going to happen because the French economy is going to melt down if they don't do something about their pension system. I mean, you could talk about lots of pension systems, public pension systems in the United States, for that matter, that are going to be under the same set of actuarial circumstances. Really big problems coming down the pike. But France right now has got to do this thing. And they narrowly passed legislation saying that people have to retire at 62. It's laughable. I mean, I guess they're doing the right thing. But ultimately, it's going to have to be 64 and 66. And, you know, people are living longer. And you just can't. So when a country basically stops having kids and a country starts to live a lot longer, the numbers don't add up. Especially when people want more and more and more to retire on and they don't save anything. I mean, and, you know, of course, we can laugh now. That's us.
What should be done with sick and elderly people who are not able to afford the cost of living on their own?
There is an absolute role in a civilized society to establish a minimum basic standard of living. The interesting argument is not whether that's so, in my view. The interesting argument is, what is that minimum basic standard of living? The problem that we have today is not that we want to help the mentally ill with public resources, not that we want to help the indigent old with public resources. The question is how much. The really interesting argument is whether or not people should be different. People should have big differences based on their own behavior, and they're based on their own hard work, and based, frankly, on their own luck. Those are the really interesting debates. I have strong views on those debates because I believe that when people are allowed to keep the fruits of their labor more, they tend to create more earned success for other people. But that's very different than the argument that we should zero out a minimum basic standard of living for all people. So in answer to your question, we need to help people who are indigent. The question is how much, and of course, even more importantly, how we do it. That's the interesting work that happens at the American Enterprise Institute every day of the week.
You argue that the Tea Party is a legitimate organization fighting for free enterprise in the culture war. There are accusations of racism against the Tea Party. What are your views?
I'm against racism. I know it's a very bold stand. From the very beginning, one of the ways that you delegitimize any organization in the United States, or for that matter, in many countries around the world, is accusations of racism. If they're right, they should be gotten rid of. If they're wrong, then it's a scurrilous thing to say, and it's completely unjust, and it's something that we should bridle against very strongly. I don't know. I've never been inside the Tea Party. I've never marched in a demonstration. All I can say is that it's a legitimate organization insofar as it represents millions and millions of Americans who want to change something about their country. We do know, in point of fact, that the Tea Party is not principally motivated by racism. If there is racism there, it shouldn't be there, and we should struggle against it. But let's keep in mind the fact that it's primarily a cultural organization dedicated to the extent that it's dedicated on anything cohesive, because it's a grassroots movement. It's not centrally planned. It's dedicated to the idea that people should be freer and the government should be smaller. And that on its face is very, very different than many of the other social considerations.
Where does the growing gap in income distribution fit into the culture war you perceive between free enterprise and big government?
Well, that's largely the principal thrust of my comments, which is that the income distribution per se is not something that should be a motivation of public policy. The income distribution per se is different than trying to create a minimum basic standard of living for people and trying to provide public goods adequately. Once we do those things, most Americans, it turns out, are not very interested in difference in income redistribution. They're not interested in it. And I base that on the facts. I base that on the data, not what I wish were the case. I mean, there's an extraordinary set of surveys that ask people from different countries what they think about income redistribution. So, for example, if you ask Americans, do you believe that one of the principal activities of the government should be to redistribute income from people who have more to people who have less? Only about 33% of Americans will agree with you. If you go to Spain, 77% of people will agree with you. That's a principal activity, redistribution by government. Most Americans don't care about it. There was one study that I saw a while ago, and I can't remember the citation on it, but I'm pretty sure I could find it, that asked people around the world their views about Bill Gates. Okay? At the time, he was the richest man in the world. What's your view on Bill Gates? Let me give it to you in a nutshell, how Americans saw it. In the United States, people basically said, hey, I hope my kid is the next Bill Gates. You go to France, and they basically said, and I'm just going to summarize, let's burn his house and take his stuff, right? I mean, this is the difference between the United States and other countries. Why? Because we're not a society fundamentally based on envy. And why? Because most Americans think that there are pathways to earn success. Now, we can get rid of those pathways to earn success, but what do we get? We'll get a society based on envy. And once we get a society based on envy, we're going to say, it's my stuff, and I'm going to take it through legislation, and I'm going to retire at 60, and I don't care what anybody says. That path leads to iniquity. Just ask President Sarkozy.
Unemployment benefits allow people longer periods of being unproductive, but they also allow people to eat when they lose their jobs and allow for more careful job selection. Where do you stand on unemployment benefits?
Unemployment benefits are a compromise. They're a compromise between creating incentives for people to not work and giving people relief. Everybody knows that, and that's not up for debate. The debate is how we should come down in this compromise. Should we come down somewhere between never creating any incentives to not work and never creating not giving anybody any relief? I mean, that's really the debate that we get, and we have to come to starkly face the realities of what the data say about it. You find a huge spike in people actually taking jobs about 3 weeks before the end of unemployment benefits. That's a fact based on the data. Does that mean we shouldn't have unemployment? No. It means that's a cost of doing business, that people's that incentives matter, that behavior actually follows economic incentives. I mean, this is not exactly controversial stuff. So what do we ought to do about it? Now, there's a study that's interesting. I recommend it to your interest, by Robert Barrow, who's a professor of economics at Harvard. And he's estimated, based on the most responsible data analysis that I've ever seen on the subject in the current recession, that our current unemployment would not be in the high nines right now. It would be in the high sixes if we had not extended unemployment benefits. Now, is it right? This is really responsible data analysis. This is not ideology. He's not an ideologue. He's a data-crunching economist, taking where he believes the data take him. Now, still, I haven't told you that you should believe we shouldn't have unemployment benefits, because maybe 3 percentage points on the unemployment rate is still worth it. But that's what we have to decide. My view is, having lived in the United States and having lived in Europe, is that the fact that Spain, for example, has about 20% unemployment and about 40% unemployment for people between the ages of 18 and 25 is a direct result of the fact that they have much more rigid employment situations and much more lavish unemployment benefits. That is too high. We can't go in that direction because, once again, the greatest tyranny is taking away people's pathways to earn success. Now, easy for me to say, I'm not spending a week on the unemployment rolls, but I am looking at the data. And I can tell you two things. Increasing unemployment benefits will lead people to be longer in the unemployed, the non-working force, number one. And number two, that's much worse for them than it is for the rest of our society, including all of us who are paying the taxes. It's really not about that. It's about what it does to them and their flourishing and their earned success. And that's an ethical matter.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, a little less than 2 minutes. So can you give us a short explanation of how less corporate taxes will raise the tide of the economy as a whole, and how would it help the working class American?
If we lower corporate taxes, we will be competitive with, get ready for it, Sweden. Sweden has corporate taxes that are a third lower than ours, and that's the reason that companies are leaving the United States and going to Sweden. You know, ask your congressman why he's not trying to keep jobs in America. I should say why she's not trying to keep jobs in America, because I'm in San Francisco. And why is it that corporate taxes are not actually adjusted to be competitive with our allies and competitive with, indeed, our competitors? Because that's costing real jobs. If we were to lower corporate taxes, we would be helping along these lines. Even though you might not like CEOs who make 400 times more than their average workers, if you like the workers and you like their jobs, you're going to get more of them if you create economic incentives that don't push people beyond America's borders. And that's the reality, once again, that comes from the data and the consequences that proceed therein.
One last comment from a questioner that requires no answer. Money cannot buy happiness, but it can buy an occasional grin. Our thanks to Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, and author of the new book, The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening on radio and the Internet. This program has been a part of the Principles of a Free Society series underwritten by the Corrett Foundation. I'm Lance Izumi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.